Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, we tackle the controversy over inflammatory speech on college campuses and where the First Amendment comes into play. Also, COVID cases are on the rise. We'll talk about an effort to provide music therapy to exhausted medical staff. But to start, New Jersey Governor Murphy shocked environmentalists recently with three of his nominees to the State Pinelands Commission. Murphy is a progressive who's long championed environmental causes, and the nominees in question represent corporate interests, the chemical industry, a communications firm, and a wind developer. The commission is charged with protecting New Jersey's treasured million-acre Pinelands Preserve while allowing some economic growth. And amid the uproar, the administration pulled one of the nominees in question. But still, conservationists fear that if the remaining two are confirmed, it will weaken the commission's commitment to environmental protection. We're going to take a deep dive into this story now with John Hurdle, a freelance environmental journalist and regular contributor to NJ Spotlight News. Welcome, John.
Thanks for having me.
So a lot of people have been scratching their heads over these choices. Has Governor Murphy vindicated his rationale?
Governor Murphy has not. And the environmentalists that I've spoken with have been kind of blindsided and really rather baffled by this, by these three nominations. The nominations are for Elvin Montero, who is the Deputy Executive Director of the Chemistry Council of New Jersey. That's a chemical industry trade group. Devon McCurry, who is an executive with Ørsted, the Danish wind energy giant that's proposing to build two wind farms off the coast of New Jersey. And finally, Laura Matos, who is managing director of Kivit, which is a national communications and PR firm. And when these nominations were announced about 10 days ago, there was a storm of protest from the environmental lobby. What they accused the governor of attempting what they called a corporate takeover of the Pinelands Commission, and they were especially upset about Mr. Montero, and they said that he would be subject to conflict of interest if he took his place on the commission. I mean, one of the other serious, very loud complaints that the environmentalists made was that this slate of candidates would replace seasoned environmentalists who had served on the Pinelands Commission for a long time, particularly Ed Lloyd, who is a retired law professor and has been on the Pinelands Commission since 2002. And the other point that the environmentalists were making is that these nominations very much went against the grain of Governor Murphy's environmental policies.
Sure. Well, still, John, there is indication that after all this uproar, the administration is sensitive to blowback from environmentalists. Tell us about the meeting last week between officials and environmental groups.
First of all, the environmental groups were planning a week ago today to hold a press conference to urge the governor to drop all three nominations. And the administration, in response to that, the day before, they reached out to the environmentalists. They said, "Well, come to Trent and we'll talk about this." And there was a meeting last Monday at which resulted in the administration dropping their nomination of Mr. Montero, but keeping the other two.
And environmentalists are still upset about this, that the remaining two are still in play.
Some of them are concerned. There is some uncertainty about the McCurry particularly the McCurry nomination, since he works for an environmental company and was previously a staffer with the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. It's it, it I think the environmentalists are saying that they're kind of waiting and seeing whether Mr. McCurry will actually vote in an environmental way if he is confirmed to the commission.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see how the development of offshore wind farms, if you will, would actually affect the Pinelands Preserve, perhaps cables running through and that sort of thing. But we won't know because Governor Murphy so far is tight-lipped about all of this.
That's right. Yeah. And there is a concern that Mr. McCurry, as a representative of Orsted, there might be a conflict of interest there, because Orsted will need, when it brings its power onshore and connects to the grid, it may need to go through parts of the Pinelands, and that would, in their view, result in a conflict of interest that may result in his recusal.
So, John Hertel, let's take a look at the commission as it stands right now. It's supposed to comprise 15 members, correct? I mean, how many people are currently sitting on the commission? And who exactly appoints them? We know the governor has some picks. Who else?
The counties. So the governor has seven picks. The counties, there are seven, parts of seven counties are within the Pinelands National Reserve. And so they also have seven picks, and there is one federal pick. And if the current slate of nominees is confirmed by the Senate, then there would be 12 sitting members out of the 15. So in other words, so there would still be three vacant seats as of the end of this current lame duck session in the legislature.
Yeah. And if they are confirmed, what proportion approximately would tilt toward environmental protection, and which toward what proportion toward industry?
Well, what I'm hearing is that from the environmental side is that the best case scenario is that they would get six out of the 12 votes on their side. But it's very uncertain. And that's their best case at the moment.
So for those of us who are not too familiar with the Pinelands Preserve, tell us a bit about this vast swath of largely, you might say, untouched land, which was given federal protection in 1978.
It was, and then New Jersey agreed to take over management of it the year after. And I think that one of the remarkable statistics about the Pinelands is that it comprises 22%, that is more than a fifth of the total land area of New Jersey. As you mentioned in the introduction, is 1.1 million acres, parts of seven counties, and it's the biggest open space between on the Atlantic seaboard between Boston and Richmond.
Wow. And also, you know, underneath this is an aquifer with 17 trillion gallons of pretty much pristine water.
Yes, the vast Kirkwood-Cohansey aquifer, and associated aquifers supply water to an estimated 2 million people in New Jersey. And environmentalists are very concerned about this because it's a very shallow aquifer and it's overlaid by porous sandy soil, which is vulnerable to chemical contamination. Yeah. So that's one of the reasons why the environmental lobby is so concerned about the prospect of additional development in the Pinelands.
Well, yeah, guessing it's been a real challenge over the years for the commission to balance environmental protection with the pressure to bring economic growth. I mean, when development happens in the Pinelands Preserves, where does it tend to happen? On the periphery, John? Do we know?
What I'm hearing is that there hasn't there's been a kind of a lull in residential development in the Pinelands area since the Great Recession of the mid 2000s, because that kind of knocked the wind out of the housing market. But the fear now is that there's going to be increased pressure for development in the Pinelands because the housing market is recovering. And the other thing that we should say about development there is that there have been two natural gas pipeline projects in recent years, one of which was built and the other was actually cancelled. And they've and that one is going through around about a 20-mile stretch of the Pinelands.
We've got a tweet from Jay who asks, do Murphy's Pinelands appointments have any environmental credentials? I think we'd value that kind of thing, but here we are, says Jay.
Well, indeed, and I think it's fair to say that that Mr. McCurry, for one thing, does have some environmental credentials since he used to work for the New Jersey DEP, and as we mentioned, he's part of this very large offshore wind company. So, so I think the environmental lobby is probably cautiously optimistic that if he is confirmed to the Pinelands Commission, that they may be able to count on his vote.
Email from Kate, who says anyone in New Jersey should raise heck about this Murphy plan for the Pinelands Commission. I wish we Philadelphia residents had a voice there. Thinking of the Pinelands as the lungs and blood of our region is no exaggeration, much as the Amazon provides oxygen to the world. You know, what do you think of that comment as an environmental journalist? What's your perspective?
Well, I think that's probably fair comment, and one thing to bear in mind is that the aquifer, this enormous aquifer that underlies the Pinelands, it contributes about 90% of the streams that run through the Pinelands, including. Including the Rancocas Creek, which flows into the Delaware River slightly north of the intakes on the intake for Philadelphia, and therefore is a significant contributor to clean water, to the water supply that Philadelphians drink.
Yeah. And again, John Hurdle, Governor Murphy's nominations need to win approval in the state Senate before they can be seated. Any anticipated roadblocks there?
No, there seems to be a fair degree of confidence that the nominations will go through the Senate, but there is a question mark since a slate of nominations that Governor Murphy submitted earlier, around about 3 years ago, has been held up in the Senate since then, and so there is. Perhaps some reservations as to, you know, if the Senate couldn't deal with those, then maybe they'll find a reason to object now. But that apparently is not going to happen.
Well, it's a lame duck session, so we should find out soon.
Indeed.
Yeah. Well, John Hurdle, thank you so much for joining us. It was a pleasure.
You're welcome.
John Hurdle is a freelance environmental journalist and a regular contributor to NJ Spotlight News. Up next, we'll hear from University of Pennsylvania professor Sigal Ben-Porath about an uproar on Penn's campus after a controversial Ecuadorian political figure was invited to Penn as a visiting scholar. The question of free speech on campus, even if it's inflammatory, that's just ahead on the regional roundup. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. In this next interview, we're going to address a question which is roiling many colleges and universities, and that is whether controversial figures whose speech or actions might be deemed offensive should be given a platform to express their views on campus. There have been a few examples locally in recent months. Maria Paula Romo is a former minister of government for Ecuador, whose invitation by Penn to do unpaid research spurred an online petition from thousands of opponents. Romo has been accused of allowing police to use tear gas canisters during anti-government protests. And Penn State supported the right of a student group to invite right-wing provocateur Milo Yiannopoulos, even as it expressed repugnance for Yiannopoulos' views. At stake, said Penn State, was the First Amendment. Other institutions have taken a different tack, disinviting such figures. So what place should contentious speech or protest hold in campus discourse? Sigal Ben-Porath is a professor of education at the University of Pennsylvania, and she is author of the book Free Speech on Campus. Welcome to the Regional Roundup.
Thank you so much for having me.
And let me give the number in case folks want to touch base and join the conversation. 888-477-9499. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. So, Sigal, let's begin by talking about students. Protest is nothing new. You point out in your book there were rowdy and sometimes violent marches during the time of the Vietnam War, and free speech was at the heart of campus struggles then. So flash forward to today. Students can be just as fervent. And in a presentation on YouTube a few years back, as chair of Penn's Committee on Open Expression, you said you got the sense that the way students were being portrayed wasn't necessarily justified. Tell us more.
Well, it's pretty common these days to talk about students as being coddled, as being snowflakes, as being overly sensitive, and really to blame them for refusing to listen to opinions that are counter to their own. But in fact, through my work as the chair of the Committee on Open Expression at Penn, as well as, you know, working around many, many campuses in the U.S. and internationally since then, I've really come to realize that students are really trying to push for greater commitment to democratic values that we all are, or many of us are, advocating for, right? So if we are looking to make sure that our public spaces are welcoming to everyone, that people can speak freely and express their views, we have to make sure that the kind of speech that we're endorsing, especially at educational institutions, is not a speech that is silencing or excluding some members of our community. And so students are really pushing for that. And sometimes they do it, you know, zealously, and sometimes they need to be educated about appropriate ways of protesting or objecting to certain opinions. But I really think that rather than trying to reject or criticize students, we ought to listen to them because, generationally speaking, they have something important to say.
Yeah. So as far as university leadership is concerned, generally, you know, across the country on college campuses, let's use the example of Milo Yiannopoulos, who, you know, often in his speech is transphobic and et cetera. Are there benefits to students in interacting with controversial, even offensive speakers? As I said in the introduction, some proponents say this, you know, teaches students how to question inflammatory speech.
Right. So I definitely think that there is a lot of benefit to interacting with speakers who you disagree with their views, right? But some people, and I think Milo is a case in point, and there are some other ones, a handful of them, really are not there to interact, to engage, to challenge. They are there to troll, you know. They are there to just express as extreme view as they can in order to enrage, and oftentimes in order to benefit themselves, maybe selling a book or getting speakers' fees. This is not, in my view, a productive place for the university. I'm not saying that these speakers don't have a place in the public sphere. It's not an effort to silence them. But the university is in the business of knowledge. It's in the business of expanding minds and thinking about ideas. If you want to be grand, it's in the business of truth, right? And so really, I don't think that the university needs to be committed to hosting people who are there only just to serve as provocations rather than looking to engage and really expand minds. And I really think that the most important place for a university is not in being a part of a general marketplace of ideas. You know, of course, it's a part of what we do. And of course, we are committed to maintaining a commitment to the legal boundaries of speech and the First Amendment, etc. But the marketplace of ideas that we endorse is one that is based on scientific principles, on ideas of promoting truth and knowledge for the common good. And so the people who we choose to invite should be ones that are committed to similar ideas and that are helping us to promote them.
Yeah. Well, Penn's campus, as so many others, is diverse, and not everybody is going to agree with everybody else. So how should university leadership separate the trolls, if you will, from the legitimate, if you will, speakers whose opinions might be offensive to say somebody who's more conservative versus somebody who's liberal, or liberal versus conservative, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, I think, first of all, it's important to recognize that the university itself, even administratively, is a very diverse space, right? So we have a lot of different units. You mentioned the Romo case.
Yes.
This is an invitation that came out of a specific unit within the University of Pennsylvania. It's not a university appointment, right? And so part of what university leaders need to do, and are actually normally pretty good at doing, definitely at Penn, but in many other places, too, is really to let the different units operate independently, right? If you have a department or a center or a student group, let them do the work of figuring out who's an interesting speaker, engaging, relevant, thoughtful speaker, and let them do the invitation. Universities, and again, it's definitely typical of Penn, do not engage in reviewing and censoring speakers or visitors that are coming to the different units. And part of the diversity of thought that we are able to incorporate into our daily work, and part of the reason why universities are such robust and lively context for free expression and for diverse views, is that the university is not speaking in one voice, and the university leader is not really going over the list of invitees and making sure that everyone adheres by the party line. You know, we have speakers coming from many diverse perspectives, and this is our strength, right? And so this is really a diversified set of inviters or context into which the speakers come. And of course, sometimes, you know, generating disagreement or even protest or even a strong objection. And that is a part of what we do, right? And we need to protect the opportunity that students and others would have to object to some of the speakers coming in. That doesn't mean that we would disinvite them or silence them.
Right.
It would really just mean that we will hear counter voices in response to their views.
So let's get some parameters around objection. So, you know, if students are passionate and they don't like perhaps what a speaker might be having to say, how should the dialogue look? I mean, sometimes, you know, the thought occurred to me that, well, you know, if a speaker, say, is shouted down, then there's no conversation there. I'm not saying wrong or right. I'm just saying, well, you can't really hear and perhaps not respond in a way that might be fruitful. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, there are some efforts around the country, notably at the University of California, Irvine, to try and create very clear parameters for appropriate protests and responses. And there is surely a concern about students or others using what is sometimes called the heckler's veto, right? So yeah, basically heckling or shouting down a speaker to the point that the conversation cannot continue. This is really an issue on the very, very narrow margins of events that we are hosting.
Sure.
But we need to pay attention to that as well. And I think one of the important ways of doing so is by initially creating the conditions where the speaker is not standing on a platform and pontificating or trying to persuade students and others with their views, but rather creating contexts in which there is initially engagement set up as a part of the event.
So right? what does the event look like? What does the setup look like then?
So, for example, one of the ways in which we've been doing it one of the ways in which colleagues, for example, at Middlebury, after they've had some issues, have developed
Charles Murray,
right,
a few
platforms
years ago. Yeah.
Right, for doing that through their engaged listening project is really to try and, for example, start off with the speaker speaking for a minute or two, and then we have small group conversations and exchanges where the speaker is walking around and engaging with the audience, and then we can have a more open maybe lecture or a small talk offered by the speaker, and then you have a more open and interactive exchange with the visitor or the speaker that is not just based on, 10 minutes, two or three questions, as is the typical academic structure, but rather allowing the speaker to more deeply engage through a workshop context or through other formats with diverse opinions and with responses, including evolving responses to their views. Well, you said something I really didn't think about. I think I disagree, but let me try to process this, to work this through with you, right? Rather than resorting to shouting or leaving because really my voice has not been given any space in the context of this event, right?
We are speaking with Sigal Ben-Porath, Professor of Education at the University of Pennsylvania. And I just did want to kind of refresh for our listeners. We'd actually addressed the Middlebury College story a number of years ago in which Charles Murray, author of The Bell Curve, controversial publication, tried to speak. And then there was such a that there were some injuries in the crowd and et cetera. So that's, in moving forward, you were addressing that. Sigal, how should we define hate speech on a college campus?
Well, I think, first of all, before we even define, it's important to remember that hate speech is protected by the First Amendment. And so, in fact, even if we reach a clear definition of hate speech, that doesn't mean that we are going to censor, prevent, or punish it, right? Because it is protected speech, legally speaking. However, at the university, what we need to think about is how do we create an inclusive climate where diverse views and diverse people are able to be heard, to speak and be heard, right? And so hate speech for me is really a form of expression that is silencing to some people in the audience, right? And so, for example, if you are questioning whether people with a certain identities belong in your classroom or on your campus, and if you are expressing a strong view that they don't belong or that they have nothing to contribute, or you are questioning their standing as someone who can know, right? Because we are focusing on knowledge in our work. These are all potentially forms of hate speech. But what does that mean, right? It means that you are not doing your work. If you're a professor, right? If I'm engaging in hate speech, I'm actually failing in my work as a teacher, as a researcher, because if I cannot hear the voices of some of my students or others in my classroom, then I am unable to take into account the diverse perspectives that I have to work with, right? And so I think what we need to do with hate speech is really we need to figure out a way, first of all, to ensure that it does not actually silence people that are members of our community or around our community, our learning community or our campus community. And then we need to figure out a way to counterbalance the burden that hate speech puts on the shoulders of those people who are being silenced, right? So we need to represent our values of inclusion more effectively.
The ACLU, which, fights for the free expression of all ideas, says that, we're, and I'm kind of paraphrasing here, where hate speech is concerned, more speech, not less, is the answer. So, in other words, to counter with more speech.
Right. Although I do think that sometimes at an educational setting or a learning setting, hate speech really has no room. Right. So the ACLU speaks, of course, about the general democratic context, and that's, of course, accurate. But in the learning community, sometimes you can say that this view doesn't have room in my class.
Well, we're running short on time. I want to get to a couple of comments here. Dave tweets, hosting provocative views that are held in good faith is part of the college experience. Hosting grifters, like the ones who you cited, and I'm assuming he's referring to Milo Yiannopoulos, is encouraging grifters. All controversial or inflammatory speech is not created equal. And then we have an email from Patty who says, some of the extremists with inflammatory speech seek to talk at events on campuses in bad faith. Their goal is to inflame and put the university in the position that if they decline to invite them to speak, university officials are open to accusations of hypocrisy and of not supporting the free exchange of ideas. I've got about a minute left. What are your thoughts?
So I really agree with that. A university is not in the business of platforming. A university is in the business of inquiry. This is what we do. We are looking to expand knowledge for the public and common good, right? And so people who are willing to engage with that and who are coming in good faith should be welcome with their diverse opinions and views. People who are looking for other causes, you know, can rent, a platform elsewhere. And public universities cannot always make these distinctions because they are more restricted by the First Amendment requirements than private institutions. But in terms of what we are committed to doing, we are committed to inclusion, truth, and knowledge, right? And so we are looking to engage with others who share these values.
Now, 30 seconds left. Should students be part of the invitation process?
Surely students themselves do a lot of invitation through their organizations on campus. And in some cases, it's definitely appropriate to engage students in the process. Students are part of our search committees for new colleagues. They are sometimes part of selecting visitors, and it's quite appropriate to have them participate. It's a learning experience, and their voice is important.
Sigal Ben-Porath, thank you so much for joining us. Went very quickly. We appreciate your visit. Professor of Education at the University of Pennsylvania and author of Free Speech on Campus. Stay with us on the Regional Roundup. Up next, we talk about grants for music therapy going to local hospitals to help frontline healthcare workers who are under the stress of continuously dealing with COVID. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Another stressful year is coming to a close for many frontline hospital workers, exhausted by the roller coaster that is COVID-19. Health officials say coronavirus cases are again on the rise in many parts of Pennsylvania, particularly in areas with low vaccination rates, and the increase in COVID cases comes just as flu season is setting in. There are also concerns about the new Omicron variant. However, as healthcare professionals struggle with stress and burnout, there is hope for sustenance in the promise of music therapy. The Pennsylvania Council on the Arts is awarding grant money to hospitals across the state to develop music therapy programs for frontline employees. A number of hospitals in the Philly area already have received grants of $25,000 each, including Einstein Medical Center Montgomery. Anne-Marie Papa is vice president and chief nursing officer. She calls this psychological PPE. Good to have you with us, Anne-Marie.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
And also joining us, music therapist Laura Tomei, who works in both healthcare and hospice. Welcome, Laura.
Oh, welcome. Thank you. Yes. Pleasure to be here.
Anne-Marie, to you first, who would have thought that this time a year ago, COVID would still be a threat? What are you hearing from your staff about the marathon challenge of dealing with this virus?
It sure is a marathon. And I think, Mary, we were hoping that we were hopeful in the summer that maybe we were starting to see the end of it, but looks like we're seeing a bit of an uptick again. I think the only good thing about this is that the people who are vaccinated who get COVID get it at a much less severe response. And the people who are not vaccinated really tend to struggle with the difficulty breathing and need to be proned and, God forbid, have to be put on a ventilator.
Yeah.
It's been a challenge for that. And I think nurses were hopeful that, wow, we're going to have a vaccine and we're going to be getting out of this hamster wheel, so to speak. But we're back in it again.
And there's a lot of exhaustion.
It's a different type of exhaustion. I've been a nurse for 45 years, and there's always a little bit of stress and a little bit of burnout and, you know, moral distress and compassion fatigue with what you do. But this feels like, you know, we've finished it. a little bit, and now we're back on it again, and we didn't really even have a chance to heal from the first time. So it feels very different, which is why I'm really thrilled to be able to be part of this structured music program that we're going to hopefully develop.
Well, let's bring Laura Tomei into the conversation. Laura, many of us have not experienced music therapy. Describe it for us and tell us a bit about the different forms it might take.
Well, music is as varied as your own personal experiences with music in your own life. I sometimes think the best way to describe it is if you just drew a line on a piece of paper and created a timeline of significant events in your life, both sad, happy, joyful, just ones that really are meaningful to you, and attach a piece of music, a song, even a sound to them, it will really start to show you how music is so embedded in every aspect of our life, from rituals and means of celebration, from just like getting out after work and going to a club and dancing your face off, or perhaps if you're musical, songwriting or playing or being in a choir. There's so many aspects of music and how it touches our lives. And music therapy is really a clinical and evidence-based practice on the use of music interventions to accomplish goals dependent on the client or patient. And that can be wide-ranging, from playing music for someone to relax to, engaging them in active music making for many different reasons, using music to help regulate gait or respirations. So it really is rather broad, but we know that music has a stunning and positive impact on our mood, and we can really transform mood in very short amounts of time within the space of a song. And we desperately need that to really kind of put some joy and space back into the time that we're spending caring in these very intense times.
Well, so when it comes to crafting a program that will aid the staff in the go atmosphere of a hospital setting, what are your thoughts here? What are your thoughts about putting this together?
Well, we, Anne-Marie and I, had several chances to speak about this, and it's my thoughts are, first of all, it's just thrilling. It's exciting to be able to look at this, but my initial thought is I need to really work with Anne-Marie and her team to get the voices of the direct care staff involved, because what works for me might not work for them. So I really need to co-create a program with the whole system and with the two units that we're going to be working with, and figure out what's going to work with them. Because the thing about music therapy is it really can promote resilience, but they've got to have a buy-in. They've got to feel that they have some control over the program we're creating, and it's got to be theirs.
Yeah. Anne-Marie, you play cello and you participated in orchestra.
Yes.
You've been talking to our producer, Paige-Marie Bessler. So have there been times during your nursing career when music has transported you away from some of these challenging emotions? And might this figure into the construction of a music therapy program for your staff?
Absolutely. You know, it does bring joy, but it also can bring challenges. Just a simple example, we have lullaby bells that we play when a baby's born. And everybody hears the bells and everybody's like, oh, wow, look, a baby was just born. It's really fun. And everybody, you know, stops for a second. But then you have the young woman that is experiencing a miscarriage that overhears those bells. So we got feedback from one of our patients. So we now have a process in place that when that is happening, we don't play the bells there. So I think to Laura's point, it's really understanding what is it that the staff want and need for their program and make it theirs, not try to fit, okay, here's a music program, here it is, it's round, and we're going to put it in this square peg hole. You know, it's going to be their program, and they're going to help us to develop it, which is why I think it was really ingenious of HAP to move forward with these grants for us. Yeah. We're really thrilled.
Well, I know the day of a nurse can be long in a hospital, 12-hour shift, and sometimes it's very busy, and maybe you don't get a chance for lunch or your break or et cetera. So, you know, in your mind, what are you seeing? So, you know, a break, and they can maybe go into a room and dance off some of the stress, or go into another room and put a headset on and listen to soothing music. What are your thoughts there, Anne-Marie?
Whatever it is that we do, we need to bring it to them, or have something that they can experience at a time that works for them. I can't say to them, you have to go at 9 o'clock or you don't get to go. You know, this is going to be something that needs to be, as Laura said, fluid and yep. agile and there when they want to experience it. In the holidays, we used to have a volunteer harpist that came, and our hospital has a really nice atrium. And when that harpist came, people just walked through on their own time that worked for them, not a scheduled time. So that's what we need to do. And we have to remember that healthcare workers are there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It doesn't stop at 5 o'clock. 3 o'clock in the morning is sometimes the time that really is needed for our staff to downsize and to downgrade and feel like, wow.
Yeah. Laura, let's talk about the types of music that you might be considering. Are some more conducive to the benefits of music therapy? And as Anne-Marie was suggesting, there are all sorts of different parameters going here. You might have somebody who needs to have a real lift, and maybe some crazy dance music might do it for them. But at other times, you've got jangled nerves, and maybe something with a big decibel level isn't appropriate. What do you normally use when you work with patients? How do you construct your programs to make it most beneficial to them?
It all comes from them. So you just described two very different needs and the potential for two very different types of music. And within that, we have so many different genres that might speak to a particular individual that we're working with. So for instance, I've worked a lot in hospice and I've worked in pediatric hospice. So sometimes we need something that's very soothing just to allow an intervention to take place, for instance. So if we're working with nurses in the hospital where they just have gone from patient to patient to patient and they're just need that, maybe it's a 5 or 10 minute break. What do they need? I don't know. They're going to tell us and then we're going to design that to help them. We may put a listening room or a listening space. We may have, I've done songwriting with staff before, just to express what they're going through. Sometimes there are key songs that everyone on a particular unit likes, and that's the song for a crazy afternoon. You know, it's like that's just your discharge song to discharge that energy, because caretaking in this environment, particularly in the pandemic, requires such acuity of focus, and the stress is just unbelievable when you have patient after patient after patient that's in a critical situation. And so where's the de-stress for the staff? How do they kind of refresh? And you can do that. I mean, there's a nurse on Anne-Marie's team that has a podcast labeled Better Mood. So that's, you know, she's already doing some of this for herself.
Are there any examples, Laura? I'm sorry, of just some of music bits, songs that you like, say soothing or upbeat, anything that comes to the top of your mind?
Well, it's funny. When I'm with, it can be as simple as something like Over the Rainbow. That to me is just a transformative song. It really sort of, even in the language, takes you to a different place, sure. to something more ethereal. So, and it appeals to many, many people. So I use that a lot for many different patients, even people with developmental delay. Some of my patients who are on hospice, that can be a song that has a lot of space in it to really take your own meaning from it. Hey Jude is another one I've used for a fellow who was struggling with some family estrangement. And, you know, it really kind of helped him see the love in his family situation just by kind of going through the words of the song and projecting onto them the meaning for him. So it's so individualized, and it's such a vast resource that we really have not tapped in the same way. But within a hospital, like Anne-Marie was talking about, the environment of having music at the holiday time, just playing music in the hallway and being mindful of what might be impactful,
sure,
such as the lullaby ring. But I've done caroling through the halls of hospices. I've done just strolling music through dementia units, just to really key in. And as you're playing that, as you're doing the live music, you're really looking at the response you're getting. And that's the thing. A music therapist can change that music in real time. Music is something that happens in the moment. It's live. It's ever-changing. And with especially live music, we can change that in the moment. But we can also create podcasts that have a particular tempo,
sure,
tempo, or not, yeah, terribly wide ranges of pitches. And that can be very soothing. And
a lot of promise.
So we have to look at, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of promise,
yes,
here. As we're getting to toward the top of the hour here, so I just want to get a couple more questions in. Anne-Marie, in your experience, can music change the perception of stress or even of pain?
Yes. Actually, nurses are known to sing to patients. And we
really?
Just saw a film that was produced by Carolyn Jones where a nurse actually sang to a patient that was having blood drawn. And it's very poignant. And he was developmentally challenged. And she sang, I'm not sure the name of the song, but Blue Ridge Mountain Highway, something like that, a country song. The patient liked country song. And this gentleman just connected with her. And, you know, thank God she has a good voice, but some of us don't, and we still sing, and people like it and makes them laugh.
They appreciate it.
They
I'm
do
sure.
appreciate it. It's a human connection.
When do you expect to have this program solidified and put into place at Einstein?
We have a really tight timeline for the pilot. We have to have a report to HAP by May. We can ask for a 30-day extension, so by the end of June. So we're right now in the planning phases. I would say by the end of January, we'll be in the implementation phases so that we can move forward February, March, April, study it, see what it does. Because, you know, the nice thing about this is we're probably going to have a couple of hiccups, and we're probably going to hit a couple bumps in the road as we move forward with this. But we'll learn, and we'll make it better.
Yep. Are the parameters different in, say, offering music therapy to coworkers as opposed to patients? Are there privacy issues that might be considered with staff?
Patient, this is voluntary. So the staff volunteer to be part of it. Same as the patient, we ask them, what type of music do you want? What would you like? Would you like to hear? So it's voluntary, so there should be no issue with privacy.
So many of us are caregivers in one form or another. True, if we don't take care of ourselves, we can't care for others?
Very true. You have to have your own bucket has to be filled before you can share it with anybody else. Just like when you're on an airplane, put your own air mask on before you put somebody else's on.
Yeah. And Laura, again, nurses on hospital floors, other care workers often don't have much time for breaks. You say music can be quick refreshment. What do you mean by that? How quick?
Just think of your favorite song and how quickly it can change your mood if you've had a crabby day or you're feeling a little tired or you need to go to the gym. You're not going to listen to a waltz at the gym, but the minute you put on something with a more, you know, pounding upbeat, you're going to start to feel that energetically in your body that you can start moving and getting some energy out. So it's that quick.
It's a resource with a lot of potential, and we'll be excited to see how it works out for you over at Einstein Montgomery. One more quick question. This is kind of off topic, about the 20 seconds left, Anne-Marie. What can any of us do to help relieve the load on frontline hospital workers?
Be patient. Be kind. Say thank you.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Anne-Marie Papa is Vice President and Chief Nursing Officer for Einstein Medical Center Montgomery. Thank you, Anne-Marie. And
thank you.
Our thanks to you as well, Laura Tomei, a music therapist who is working in both healthcare and hospice and with Einstein in getting this program up and running. And we've got
thank
some,
you.
You're welcome. Just some news quickly. The Philadelphia Department of Health has announced that beginning January 3rd, you must be fully vaccinated against COVID to enter any establishment in Philly that sells food or drink for consumption on site. So there's some news for you as we wrap up the hour. Our engineer today, Charlie Kyer, our producer, Paige Marie Bessler. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for joining us, and be well.